ever changed his life.
He shares. 20 years ago, I drove a cab for a living. One time, I arrived in the middle of the night for a pickup at a building that was dark, except for a single light in a ground floor window. Under these circumstances, you can't hear? Under these circumstances, many drivers would just honk once or twice, wait a minute, then drive away. But I had seen too many impoverished people who depended on taxis as their only means of transportation. Unless the situation smelled of danger, I always went to the door. This passenger might be someone who needs my assistance, I reasoned to myself. So I walked to the door and knocked. "Just a minute," answered a frail, elderly voice. I could hear something being dragged across the floor. After a long pause, the door opened. A small woman in her 80s stood before me. She was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it, like somebody out of a 1940s movie. By her side was a small nylon suitcase. The apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There were no clocks on the walls, no knickknacks or utensils on the counters. In the corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. "Would you carry my bag out to the car?" she said. I took the suitcase to the cab, then returned to assist the woman. She took my arm, and we walked slowly toward the cab. She kept thanking me for my kindness. "It's nothing," told her. "I just tried to treat the passengers the way I would want my mother treated." "Oh, you're such a good boy," she said. When we got in the cab, she gave me an address, then said, "Could you drive me through downtown?" "It's not the shortest way," I answered quickly. "Oh, I don't mind," she said. "I'm in no hurry. I'm on my way to a hospice." I looked in the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. "I don't have any family left," she continued. "The doctor said I don't have very long." I quietly reached over and shut off the meter. "What route would you like me to take?" I asked. For the next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived when they were newlyweds. She had me pulled up in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she'd ask me to slow in front of a particular building or corner and would sit staring into the darkness saying nothing. As the first hint of sun was creasing into the horizon, she suddenly said, "I'm tired. Let's go now." We drove in silence to the address she had given me. It was a low building like a small convalescent home with a driveway that passed under a portico. Two orderlies came out to the cab as we pulled up. They were solicitous in intent, watching her every move. They must have been expecting her. I opened the truck and took the small suitcase to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair. "How much do I owe you?" she asked, reaching into her purse. "Nothing," I said. "You have to make a living," she answered. "There are other passengers." Almost without thinking, I bent over and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly. "You gave an old woman a little moment of joy," she said. "Thank you." I squeezed her hand and walked into the dim morning light. Behind me, a door shut. It was the sound of the closing of a life. I didn't pick up any more passengers that shift. I drove aimlessly, lost in thought. For the rest of that day, I could hardly talk. What if that woman had gotten an angry driver, or one who was impatient to end his shift? What if I had refused to take the run, or had honked once and driven away? On a quick review, I don't think that I had done anything more important in my life. We're conditioned to think that our lives are around great moments. But great moments often catch us unaware, beautifully wrapped in what others may consider a small one. All we have is the moment. Our challenge and our gift is understanding that we have the capacity to transform our moments, to nurture and transform and develop our inner selves so that both those and we love can live a life of appreciation and acceptance. That's what we are here for today, is to transform our moments. As we learn about self-acceptance of ourself and those we love. As we look at our moments, let's look at our thinking and feeling. Your thinking and feeling are inseparable. You think, you feel. You may not always be aware of the thoughts that you are thinking or that you are even thinking at all. Thinking about something can occur over a long period of time or can take only a second. But there is a direct relationship between the thoughts that you think and the way that you feel. If you have a thought that tomorrow is going to be difficult, there is no coincidence that you're feeling a little worried. Sometimes when I have clients in my office and I try to teach them what it feels like, I'll say to them, you know, I just want to share with you, the person before you was dealing with a case of lice. And right away, especially the little ones, will start going, ugh. And I'll go, see, that's what it's like. When you think lice, you feel itchy. Oh, did I tell you the people that were here last night had lice? No, I'm just kidding. But that's what happens. You think lice when you go to lice check. Don't you all start feeling a little itchy? Okay. How many times have you really wanted to do something but found yourself thinking, I wish I could, but I wish I could sing, I wish I could dance, I wish I could cook, I wish I could draw. Fill in the blanks. How many times have you said or thought, but? Often, these excuses are followed with fear. So what I say is when you start saying, but, get off your butts and start thinking about that. You need to replace your fear with faith. Faith in yourselves. My son Avi came home from yeshiva he was in yeshiva for a year and came over the summer, home from the summer, and taught me something incredible that his rabbi, Rabbi Avi Eitan Korn, taught him. Fear stands for false evidence appearing real. F-E-A-R. A very phenomenal concept. When we start looking at this fear, we need to begin to give ourselves credit for what we have accomplished. Begin to replace the to-do list with what I have accomplished. How many diapers have you changed? How many noses have you wiped? How many emails have you answered? How many bills have you attempted to pay? It's okay. Thinking is something that we are always doing. It's easy to forget that we are thinking. There's the joke that women talk about nothing, men think about nothing, but we are always thinking. This is powerful information as we begin to strengthen our emotional selves, build self-esteem, self-acceptance, and positively transform our moments. If you continue to think how you've always thought, we're going to continue to feel how we've always felt. Get it? If you continue to think how you've always thought, you're going to continue to feel how you've always felt. So you need to shift something. Okay, this ultimately impacts how we experience ourselves and how we experience ourselves in relation to others. Okay, I want to present something. I want you to think about this. Our eyes are always looking outward. You have never truly seen yourself. Do you really know how you look? Do you really, really know how you look? Have you ever truly seen yourself? Do you really know what you look like? You are really only a reflection of yourself. It's a reflection of a mirror, a camera lens. If you look closely into the pupil of another person, who do you see? Yourself. You never really know what you look like. So who you are is a reflection of yourself. There are studies that have been shown that people's very good friends often look like themselves. There are other studies that have shown that people's dogs look like themselves. I don't really know too much about that. Okay, so what does this say about our self-esteem? You can approach life as if people are mirroring back important information to you. So the qualities that you admire in others, their strengths, abilities, and positive attributes are really characteristics you have already embraced within yourself. Isn't that great? You're hanging out with these fantastic people that are a lot just like you. Okay, now here's the clincher. It's the negative judgments that we make about others that are a little bit more difficult, because what we find wrong in others is also about ourselves. You can't find a fault in someone else unless it's also a part of you. The Gemara states, kol haposo b'mumo poso. So you can't find something negative in somebody else unless it's also a part of you. So this is how we can work with that. Approach the world accentuating the positives. Look at the life as an interactive experience, which it really is. You are constantly thinking about how you're going to interact with others. You are constantly making choices about these interactions. During the course of these interactions, you have the ability to respond or react. What does this mean? For example, somebody approaches you and they give you some criticism. You have the ability to respond to their criticism. You have the ability to react to that criticism. You can remain in control of your response, or you can react to that response. You can get upset, or you can react. When you choose to respond rather than react, you remain in control in your thoughts, of your thoughts. Your thoughts and emotions are healthier. You don't let your thoughts take over. Your emotions remain in control. There's so much good you can do with this perspective as you allow yourself to respond rather than react. What happens is you choose to be kind rather than be right. When you respond by listening, you invite others to be close to you. When you react by needing to show that you are right, you build walls and create rifts. When we allow past problems and future concerns to dominate our thought processes, we end up feeling anxious, frustrated, depressed, and hopeless. There are people that put off their happiness and gratifications, believing that someday will be a better day, only to find that someday just doesn't seem to be happening. As John Lennon put it so eloquently, life is what happens while we're busy making other plans. Living in the moment is what allows us to grow. Embracing the ability to respond rather than react allows us to come closer to other people. A painfully shy man fell in love with a young woman. He sensed that she felt the same way, but he couldn't find the courage to ask her out. Finally, he decided he would mail her a love letter every day for 1 year, and then he felt ready to ask her out for a date. Faithfully, he followed his plan. A year's end, he was courageous enough to call her. He discovered that she had fallen in love with the mailman. Yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery, and today is God's present to us. Let's start with that present, the gift of today, to make a difference in our lives and the lives of those around us. Consider approaching the world through a positive lens, with compassion for others, faith in ourselves, and a belief that God has always been and will continue to be there for us. Focus on what is important, capture the good times, develop from the negatives. Acknowledge the favorable in others and strengthen the positives within ourselves. Remember, one of the greatest gifts that we truly have is our ability to embrace the moment and then to so powerfully and positively transform our thoughts and then our feelings about ourselves and others through it.
Can I invite Deb Palin to come up? Sit in any order you can. Okay. I'm going to start with Dr. Mary Gottman. She is a psychiatrist. She is board in an adult, child, and adolescent psychiatry and is a member of the American Family Therapy Academy. Dr. Gottman is on the faculty of the Chicago Center for Family Health, a postgraduate family therapy training program, and has academic affiliations with Northwestern and Lurie's, where she supervises child psychiatry fellows, and she also runs a private practice with offices in Skokie and in Loup, and where she sees children, teens, and adults, as well as couples and families, offering a combination of psychotherapy and medication management. And that's a mouthful, right? Okay. This is Mrs. Rachie Karish. She's a licensed clinical social worker and the clinical director for the girls division at Madragos Midwest. Rachel's responsible for developing and implementing preventative as well as intervention programming. Additionally, she is responsible for the assessments, case management, and crisis intervention of referred teens. And she also has a private practice where she works with teens and adults in an array of issues. Okay, and this is Cora Gelman. She has taught 7th grade Homish for 7 years at RE Crown, and she's the founder of Fumba Chicago. And support inspires Skokie members, community members, as Repton is Chicago's most rapidly growing school, Kehillat Polvaveitzion. So I just want to say the way that this is going to work is that our panelists are going to present on their own about different topics, and then we're going to open it up for questions. If you have a question, please write it on the note card that's by your seat, and we'll come around and collect them. And we probably won't get through all of them, but we hope that we'll get through as many as possible. And as far as the panels go, when the questions come up, you all know about a lot of the topics we're talking about here. So kind of decide amongst yourselves who should answer which question. If you both want, or all three want to answer a question, we'll take a moment. So you are going to start, if that's okay, Dr. Gottman. And then we'll do...
So are you introducing my topic?
Okay.
I can introduce it myself.
Yeah, you could introduce it yourself. But basically, we have Dr. Gottman talking about women in marriage and in relationships. And we have, although she knows about other areas as well, as we said before, and Rachie is going to be talking, or Mrs. Karish is going to be talking about how our own self-image affects our children and our students, for those of us who are teachers or, you know, as role models to young people. And Mrs. Gelman is going to talk about the Torah perspective on self-image. So, hit it.
All right. I guess I first was hit with the term self-image and what that means. And the concept of self-image to me is really, and this touches on something that I don't think any of us are going to be, we're all going to play off one another. The themes are common ones. So I really responded to what Mrs. Gutstein was talking about. The concept of self-image is really similar to the idea behind a self-portrait. In other words, it is not equivalent to a photograph. A photograph of oneself, and shouldn't be seen as being an objective reality, but rather it's a subjective reflection of how one thinks and feels about oneself. Okay, so self-image is very is not at all objective. It's very subjective. How one thinks of oneself is a result of a myriad of one's own life experiences and events that you've experienced, both positive and negative, in combination with an inborn or perhaps hereditary tendency towards certain personality traits and characteristics. As everyone goes through life, you experience a myriad of things. You may experience some close personal family losses. You may experience some real-life disappointments. You may have been subject to a significant illness. All of those things are going to impact on how you think about yourself.
if there is a family history of depression or anxiety, there's a biological, a hereditary tendency within families that also are going to come to play. We're not really what we call, sometimes you refer to a child as a tabula rasa. They're just a blank slate coming into the world. And kids are not born into the world as blank slates. I've seen it over and over in my practice, I'm sure we all have, that there are really familial characteristics, hereditary characteristics, plus your own life experience, and that plays out in forming certain personality traits and characteristics of your own. Self-image is not either positive or negative. One can be, for example, positive and self-confident in some circumstances, but fairly negative and self-critical in others, depending on what kind of feelings certain situations evoke. So it's not just a constant. Oh, this person has a positive self-image, and that's the way it is throughout all aspects of her life. An individual self-image may look different in the outside world than it does within the privacy and the confines of a marriage, because of the intimate nature of that relationship and the quality of the interaction between husband and wife. So you have people that you meet in everyday life, may even be close friends, and everything looks rosy and they're so positive. And I know, and I'm sure all of us who are therapists know, that in the privacy of an office, you may see something totally different. So how one presents to the outside world may be very different from how one experiences your life in the privacy of your own walls. The generic cliche would hold that a positive sense of self will evoke a positive response from your environment and the people around you. Smile and the world smiles with you. That's true to a certain extent, and in the interest of just making your life work in the outside world, even when you're kind of grumpy and grouchy, sometimes you need to put that aside just because it's not worth the kind of feedback you're going to be getting in the workplace, for example, if all you talk about is the problems you have at home. So there's a positive social aspect sometimes to putting on a face. In a marriage, self-confidence and a healthy self-esteem certainly allows you to kind of roll with the punches and more successfully navigate the inevitable setbacks and disappointments we all experience in the course of married life. Yes, if your spouse has hit a rough patch at work and takes it out at home, you might be able to swallow your disappointment and resentment and remain supportive and upbeat to allow both of you to move forward as a team. But that's a somewhat simplistic perspective that in real life isn't always attainable. To me, self-image really means self-understanding and an honest and conscious awareness of one's needs, one's wants, and one's fears, and an awareness of one's strengths, and even more important, an awareness of one's vulnerabilities. In other words, recognizing what makes you anxious or angry, and why. It's difficult within the close confines of a marriage to act a certain part on a day-in, day-out basis. Marriage is an intimate relationship wherein a man and a woman become emotionally exposed to one another and need to feel safe in order to be able to do so without fear of exploitation or humiliation. Self-understanding allows you to be aware of what reactions certain traits in your spouse may evoke in you and why, as well as appreciating what reactions certain traits of your own may evoke in your spouse. Are you a somewhat anxious person? Are you risk-averse? You may come by this honestly with a family history of anxiety or having had certain adverse experiences growing up. But how might this impact a husband, for example, trying to start a new business venture, who may come to resent what he experiences as pessimism and a lack of confidence in his abilities? And that can have significant consequences. Pretending doesn't reliably work and can't sustain itself long term in a marriage. Spouses usually know each other too well for that. So what is really essential and more important than a sunny self-portrait is the kind of self-understanding that allows both spouses to recognize their wants, their needs, and their fears. And this is a challenge. The next step, and the most crucial and challenging one, is the facilitation of honest communication, that big C word, between husband and wife, such that each really understands what makes the other tick. Instead of defensiveness, denial, emotional withdrawal, or the impulse to go on the offensive, there can develop instead an understanding and appreciation of each other's very human vulnerabilities and frailties as well as strengths. So often I see in the course of doing couples work how angry couples are with one another, and they're just ready. It takes one little thing and they're, you know, the person is on the attack. Or instead, we don't talk. We have the silent treatment. I'm just going to withdraw. None of those things facilitate understanding and communication. And you have to be aware of the impact, because that's just going to reinforce, that's going to reinforce the split. If you can develop this honest understanding of each other's personalities and temperament, as well as the frailties, this will allow each spouse to support the other while acknowledging the difficulties there may be in doing so. Such efforts are then doubly appreciated and serve to bring a couple even closer. In other words, you have a husband who knows that you're really anxious about things, or really scared about taking risks. If you can go out there and you can say, you know that I'm anxious about this sort of thing, but I really believe in you, I really trust and have confidence in you, your husband, if he knows you well and recognizes, he will recognize the effort that that takes and the emotional strength that that takes, and that will really serve to bring you closer. The marital challenge is to attain the confidence to absorb the bumps in life without becoming, and I say address this particularly to women, without becoming a martyr or a victim in the relationship, and being able to speak up for yourself and communicate honestly without becoming controlling and critical. That's really a challenge. Okay? That's not easy to do. Thus, we have morphed, by way of summary, from the notion of the positive self-image to that of an honest and perhaps more vulnerable self-portrait that is really critical to the development of true marital intimacy. So that's just by way of summary. There are lots of different things that that can lead to. So I'm going to close here. Do we want to just all present, and then as people have questions?
Yes, first off. Okay, I'm going to just start with a short but very powerful video. This works here.
I worry that she's inherited. Oh gosh. My number one hate on my body is
my eyes are wonky.
I have very big legs.
I'm not keen on my legs, but I just try to focus on the fact that they're very strong and that I'm a very good runner.
I have a belief that the fact that I smile a lot
has a lot to do with why my skin stays nice.
We don't like eyes. Oh, she said her thighs too, didn't she? She said her legs. We both don't like our nose. I think don't like my arms, and she doesn't like her arms either.
So I put hips, some sort of bum areas, sort of upper thighs, and Louise put her legs as well.
I have tried to make my girls feel good. Well, I did say to her, I don't like this thing of, you know, this body parts of mine, and I think that's why she probably picked it up.
Yeah, looking at it, she really picks up a lot of my ways. She does.
Just be confident with yourself and how. Just realize how you can influence your child. Have a look closer at things that I like.
Boom.
Yeah, I don't like my bum.
I like my face because it's smiley.
Legs, you wrote legs. Why do you like your legs?
Because they're good for running.
Really? Mm-hmm.
So self-worth and beauty, it is an echo. It can echo from me to them and then from them to others.
Be happy. Just be happy. Yeah.
How I feel about myself really affects how she feels about herself.
Why do you like your mole then?
Because it's the same as yours.
Okay. It's a powerful video. Yeah. So it's estimated that 91% of women are dissatisfied with their bodies. That's a huge number. That means for every 100 women, there are only 9 women that are actually satisfied with the way that they look. In today's culture, in our society today, there's such an emphasis on being beautiful and being thin that it's almost impossible for our children to escape these messages. Everywhere they look, television, magazines, internet, billboards, even toys like Barbie, our children are being bombarded with these messages of the perfect woman. And the problem is, right, we all know this perfect woman doesn't exist. It's airbrushed and digitally altered models. It's unrealistic toys. So essentially, society has us all chasing this illusion, this unattainable illusion. Our children are being exposed to unrealistic proportions, and it's not just the emphasis, it's not just the unrealistic proportions, but it's also the emphasis on the external as opposed to the internal. I don't know how many of you here have ever heard the real facts about Barbie, but they say that if Barbie were an actual woman, she would be 5'9". Weigh 110 pounds, have an 18-inch waist, 39-inch bust, and have a size 3 shoe. At 5'9" and weighing 110 pounds, Barbie would have a body mass index of 16.24 and actually fit the weight criteria for anorexia nervosa. And by the way, this is true with our boys as well. It may look a little different with our sons, right? Our sons have a different ideal body image out there. Our sons have toned bodies and six packs and big biceps, but it's true for our sons as well. They're also trying to chase this unattainable image, and it's also having very negative consequences on our sons as well. And for our boys, instead of Barbies, it's action figures and superhero costumes, right? My sons have these superhero costumes that the six packs and the muscles are already built into the costumes. So we have our boys as well. It may look a little bit different, but the theory is really the same. So I think the problem is very clear. The question is, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to teach our children to love themselves when everything around them is really telling them to question their externals? And perhaps even more importantly, how are we supposed to teach our children to accept themselves when we may be having trouble accepting ourselves? How do we combat something that's so backwards yet so pervasive? How are we supposed to protect our children? So I would like to just maybe suggest 4 different things that we can do in order to protect our children and help build our children's self-esteem, and specifically as it relates to body image. okay? So in the short amount of time. Number one is role modeling. It's very, very well documented that the best form of education is done through role modeling. As we just saw in this very powerful video, even if we tell our children, you're beautiful, but I look so fat, right? This can have very detrimental effects. If we want our children to be comfortable in their, and by the way, I'm speaking about parents and children, but I'm also supposed to be addressing students. So everything I'm saying right now, you can apply to the teacher-student relationship as well. I'm just talking about it as a parent-child, and that's really, since that's really the primary relationship. So if we want our children to be comfortable in their own skin, then we really have to be comfortable in our own skin. And the opposite is true as well, right? If we're going to be so anxious about the way that we look, if we're going to, every single time we put on the clothing, talk about, oh my gosh, how fat I look in this outfit, our children are going to absorb that. We need to be modeling to some degree body comfort, acceptance, and appreciation for what our bodies are and what our bodies do. And this extends to mealtime as well. Mealtime should be about enjoyment. It should be about family time. It should be about nutrition. It's good to encourage our children to be healthy and to be, you know, and to eat well, and we should be positive about that. But if every single time we're going to pick up a piece, you know, eat a piece of cupcake, we're going to talk about, oh my gosh, this is going straight to my hips, or I was so bad today, this is going to have negative impacts on our children. And if we want our children, if we want to be modeling comfort, body comfort, we really have to be avoiding negative statements about food, about body image, about body shape, and about weight. Number two is validation. We need to be actively listening to our children's concerns. So if our child comes downstairs and talks about, I can't go to school today, Mom, my hair looks so ugly, okay? Our initial response is going to want to be like, honey, you look beautiful, what are you talking about? Okay, but what we want to do is we want to validate that concern. Now, let me be clear. This doesn't mean we say, yes, honey, your hair looks ugly, right? But what we do say is, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry you feel that way, right? That really must feel really bad. And let me give you just like a quick example of why this is important. Let's say, for example, you went to work and you came home from work and you're feeling really, really, you had a really annoying conversation with one of your coworkers at work. And you come home to your husband and you tell your husband about, oh my gosh, I have to tell you about the most annoying thing that happened to me today at work. And you tell him about the whole conversation, your husband says to you, that's not annoying, why is that annoying, right? How do you feel? Really annoyed now, right? All I wanted for you to tell me is, wow, that does sound really frustrating. I don't care if you agree with me or not. That sounds really frustrating. So the same thing with our children. We need to be validating our children's concerns. When our children come down and say, Mom, I feel so ugly, I don't want to go to school today, I'm really sorry, that must feel really bad. Afterwards, it's okay to tell them, by the way, I think you're beautiful. But first, their concerns have to be validated. So we're actively listening to our children's concerns, we're validating their concerns, acknowledging that they're real, and then we're normalizing their concerns. I'm so sorry you feel that way. I remember feeling the same way when I was younger. I remember feeling really, really bad, right? We also want to be teaching our children that weight gain is a normative part of development, especially during puberty. Our children, you know, our girls, as their chests are growing and their hips are widening, they're feeling like they're getting really fat, right? So we want to be doing proactive education. We want to tell our children, by the way, you're going to be going through something called puberty, right? Your body's going to be changing. You may start to feel fat. That's not what's happening, right? I always hate when I hear like someone who's pregnant say, I feel so fat. You're not fat. You're pregnant, right? This is what's supposed to be happening. Your body's supposed to be gaining weight, right? It's a beautiful thing. You're carrying something else inside your body. So we want to be doing the same education with our children. You're not getting fat. This is beautiful. This is amazing. Your body, you're becoming a woman, and this is what's supposed to be happening to your body. Okay, so we're actively listening, we're validating, we're normalizing their concerns for them. We want them to know that they should feel comfortable coming to us with these issues. We need to keep the lines of communication open with our children. And I also want to just include in this category of normalizing, when we do see a bad message out there, when we do see something that's, you know, real, when we do see those bad messages of media, we want to call them out, right? There was a huge billboard of this of these models that are modeling thigh, like cream that tones your thighs, okay? You can put it on, it's supposed to tone your thighs. If you look at the billboard, what stands out is the models are not size 0 like they usually are. The models are maybe size 4. Our models are maybe size 6, right? What a horrible message, right? If you're anything above a size 0, use this thigh toning cream. That's an awful message. You see a billboard like that, call it out. Help your children analyze the messages that they're seeing out there. So number one is role modeling. Number two is validation. The third thing that we can do to help build our children's self-esteem is to complement their internals. Now, this is not as opposed to their externals. We want to also be complimenting their externals. It's important that they hear it from us. And for our daughters, it's very important that they're hearing it from their fathers, too. I think a lot of times fathers shy away from this area, but females need male validation, so they also need to be hearing from their fathers that they're beautiful. But ultimately, self-worth comes from within. So we need to be complimenting their achievements. We need to be complimenting their efforts, their values, right? All the things, their accomplishments. And we want to be very specific with our feedback. If in general we just tell our child, great job, it feels good, but they don't know how to incorporate that into their self-esteem, right? You want to be as specific as you can. You know, wow, I love that you went to set the Shabbos table. Not only did you go set the Shabbos table, mommy didn't even have to ask you to go set it, which means that you were really thinking about, what does my mom need right now? She needs me to help set with the Shabbos table. That was really kind and sensitive of you. That's easier for them to incorporate into their self-esteem when they have very specific feedback. I also wanted to say, as a little bit side note here, I think that I catch myself doing it a lot today, is in trying to build our children's self-esteem, we often tell our children, you're the best, you're amazing, right? My 3-year-old will come over to me with a picture that she drew, oh my gosh, this is the best scribble I have ever seen, you're an artist, right? You're amazing. But what we do is, in trying to build our children's self-esteem and telling our children, you're the best, we're giving them this underlying message that we value the best. So if I'm not the best, then maybe I shouldn't try because I don't know if that's what my parents value. When we're complimenting our children, we want to be complimenting their efforts, right? We want to be complimenting, wow, I see how hard you work at this. I see how hard you practiced. Okay, so role modeling, validation, complimenting internals, and the last and final one is building resilience. We all know as adults that life is going to throw us curveballs, right? Life throws everybody curveballs. And sometimes these curveballs are going to come in the form of a parent, right? We don't all love everything about ourselves, but we need to learn to, despite the things we don't love, we need to learn to accept the things that accept ourselves as a whole picture. And we want to kind of be giving our children the same message. Be sympathetic to the tough stuff that they're going through, but also give them the confidence that whatever they're going through is not insurmountable, right? You want to give them this message of, I'm sorry, this really isn't fun what you're going through, but I have the coping skills to get through this. I am going to be able to get through this. And one of the ways that we can do that is through teaching our children problem solving, right? We could going back to number one, we can role model problem solving, but we can also, after we listen to them, to their concerns, after we validate their concerns, instead of jumping straight to advice, well, this is what you should do, right? Ask them clarifying questions so they can build their own advice. And I'll give you a small example, but the way that I did this once with one of my kids, and it didn't have to do with body image, but you could apply this to body image the same way. I had once one of my eight-year-old sons said to me, and I don't remember what he was complaining about, because they complain often enough that I can't remember what he was complaining about, but something was very much upsetting him, and he said to me, oh, this is so annoying, my whole life stinks, right? So as a parent, I was like, oh my gosh, your whole life stinks, right? I'm not going to react, so I listened to what he had to say. I validated, wow, that must be really tough to feel like everything in your life is stinking right now, right? Can you tell me about some of the things that are hard for you, right? So he listed, well, this is really hard for me. Okay, another thing, this is really hard for me. Okay, maybe he came up with a third thing, I don't remember. And then I said to him, is there anything in your life that's good right now? And he's like, I don't know, I can't really think of anything. Do you like your family? Yeah, I like my family. Could you mind if I write that down? So write down on a piece of paper, family, okay? What about friends? Do you like your friends? Yeah, I like my friends. Okay, friends. Before you know it, we had filled up a whole sheet of paper of everything in his life that was good. And he looks at me at the end, he says, Mom, do you think I could hang this on my wall? Aww. And I said, of course you could hang this on the wall. But then I didn't have to go into the advice of, you know, well, look, not everything in your life is really bad. I didn't have to give him that whole speech. We helped build resilience, right? We helped show him that, yes, this is really tough for you. I'm not taking away from the fact that you feel ugly, you feel fat, you feel, you know, you're not happy with the way that you look. But look how much else good is going on for you. And through doing that, we're helping our children to build resilience. I just want to conclude by saying that really with the pervasiveness of body image issues, going back to that first statistic of 91% of women are dissatisfied with their bodies, I don't think we can afford to really be reactive. We need to be proactive in our education with our children and help build their self-worth and start these conversations before it even comes up as an issue.
So my task this morning is to offer insight into the Torah perspective on body image. And I found this both very exciting when Wendy asked me to speak about it, but also somewhat daunting, because when the Torah was written, clearly there were no magazines and there were no models that were Barbie dolls, right? So what is the Torah, what perspective does it give us in terms of how we should approach our body image? And I think I'm going to try to piggyback off of some of the ideas that you both spoke about. And whereas Rachie gave 4 talking points, I'd like to leave you with 3 that you can sort of revisit every time you're feeling like you're not satisfied with your body. Because, like you said, Rachie, you know, the way the video portrayed it, how we feel about ourselves very often is what we give off to our children. So what I'd like to do is offer 3 different sources from the Torah, and hopefully next time you're like, oh, my this, my that, my whatever feature is bothering you about yourself, you can come back to these 3 things and remind yourself what the Torah has to lend in terms of how you should feel about yourself. So the first source I'd like to go to is the Gemara in Maseches Tanis. There's a story that's related of Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi, who is walking from the Beis Medrash. He's on a high. He just learned a bunch of Torah. He's feeling great about himself. And he's walking along the riverbed, and he sees a horrific-looking man, disgusting-looking man. And the man says to him, Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi. And instead of responding, the Rebbe says to him, you are so ugly. And are all the people from your city so ugly? And the man, which there's a lot to be said about the Rebbe's approach to this guy and whatever, and he does tshuva in the end. But the man responds to him and tells him, Eini yodea, I don't know if I'm ugly. Go and ask the craftsman who created me. And I think the message of this Gemara is really the idea that we have to remind ourselves when we are feeling lousy, and we all feel lousy at some point about some feature that we have or even a midah that we have to remind ourselves that we are created b'tzelem Elohim. We're told in Sefer Bereishis that Adam and Chava are created in the image of Hashem. When I am feeling lousy about myself, I have to stop before I go on that roller coaster of emotion that's going to take me to I'm not worth it, I'm not worthwhile, I'm not worth being loved, I'm not worth loving myself. I have to remind myself that I am created in the image of God. God is perfect. We believe that God is perfect and all of his creations are perfect. Who am I, like this man says to the Rebbe, to contest God? Who am I to say, go to the craftsman and ask him if we're ugly? Right? I am in the image of Hashem. I am a precious child of Hashem. I am worth it. Now, this is a very lofty goal to achieve when we're feeling lousy about ourselves. But what I'd like to try to do is, how would I talk to my daughter? Right? If my daughter says to me, oh, my hair, my this, my that. So I would try to obviously implement some of the ideas that you just offered. But we have to treat ourselves very much in the same way that we would treat our children, our sons and our daughters, right? If a child were to come to us and say to us, or even anybody, I have clients who come to me constantly and say, what exercise should I do for my lower extremities? What exercise should I do for my chest? What exercise should I do for my neck? Right? And there are all kinds of exercises that you can do from here to tomorrow, right? But if we come to a place of self-love and understanding that this is, I am how Hashem made me, right? People could say, a person can offer a compliment and say, you're so pretty, I love your nose, I love your eyes. Well, thank you so much, but like, I had nothing to do with that, right? God made my nose, God made my eyes. I am just in his image. I am just a reflection of how he created me. That being said, while it is very lofty to come to that, there is a beautiful, beautiful idea that we learn from Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs written by Shlomo HaMelech, where we have this description of 2 lovers, a woman and a man. And the entire Sefer, we see that the woman's body parts are described. Her cheeks are perfect. Her hair is perfect. Her teeth are perfect. From top to bottom, this woman is perfect. Okay? And yet, in the first parak, we see that she says to the Benot Yerushalayim, to her friends, to her colleagues, who maybe are competing with her for the love of the of this guy, she says, Shchora ani v'na'ava. I am black, but I am beautiful. Now, we can see that in two ways. On the one hand, black, so she doesn't feel really so beautiful, even though she's personified as this magnificent, gorgeous woman, right? She doesn't always feel beautiful. She feels shchora, she feels black, v'na'ava. But she's able to see within her imperfections, she's able to feel still beautiful. And I think that lends a little bit about what you were saying of self-awareness, and a little bit about what you were saying also, Rachie, that no one's perfect, right? We all strive to have these, I mean, you know, I teach fitness classes, and I'm all about being, you know, developing strong, healthy bodies, right? And all these things creep into class about the perfect body and what that looks like and all the parts of our body that we're trying to work on. But it's okay to be self-aware enough and say, I'm not perfect. I'm not ever going to be perfect, but I'm a work in progress. Shchora ani v'na'ava. I'm black. I have things about me. And by the way, it doesn't just manifest itself in physical ways. It's also personality things. There are things about my personality that I can't take, right? That I can't handle, right? Like I'm looking at everyone else's notes and everyone's notes are very organized. And here I'm like all over the place, right? So I don't love that I'm not necessarily the most organized person or that I wait till the last minute to do things. I mean, everyone has things about themselves physically that make us uncomfortable and personality-wise that make us uncomfortable. But I think what we have to do is, number two, shchora ani v'na'ava. I have imperfections. I have things about me maybe physically, maybe personality-wise that aren't necessarily perfect, but I am a work in progress. I'm still beautiful. Many of you know about my journey to weight loss and how I lost a lot of weight, and it is challenging. I'm not going to lie. I'll put it right out there. It's very challenging to wake up every day, to get dressed for today. Am I going to look the way that I'm supposed to look as a fitness instructor? Am I going to look the way I'm supposed to look as a Rebbetzin? Right? We have all these like checklists of how, what we think we're supposed to look like, and sometimes you just have to take a deep breath, look in the mirror. Remember, number one, I'm created in B'Tselem Elokim. I'm exactly how Hashem wants me to be. And number two, shchora ani v'na'ava. I have my imperfections. I'm self-aware. I know that I'm a work in progress, but I'm beautiful. I feel beautiful because I'm healthy, because I'm strong, because I nurture myself and take care of myself. The third thing that I'd like to leave you with is the idea of beauty not just being on the outside, which we talked about, but really being much more than physically what we see when we just see a person. And we see that when it comes to Esther, Hamalka, so the pasuk tells us that she was green, and the mafarshim all go kind of crazy over whether what does that mean? Does it mean she was exceedingly beautiful? We know in the actual text that it says that she found favor in Ahasuerus's eyes, and all the girls who she was with, she found favor in their eyes. Something about her made people attracted to her, made people want to know her, want to be with her, want to be around her. And Rashi there comments. And he says it wasn't just her physical beauty. He says Kehadas says her other name was Hadas, so she had olive-colored skin. But he elaborates and he says it was her chesed that made her beautiful. And I would venture to say that if I were to poll all of you in this room, we have an image of what we think is beautiful, of a person who we think is beautiful. I know for myself, there are two women in my life who I think of as beautiful. They both happen to be Rebbetzins. One is Rebbetzin Elke Grumman, who was my Rebbetzin growing up. She opened her home to the entire community. She was just a tzaddik. She is a tzaddikess. She is just a stunning person. She happens to be physically beautiful, but not so much because of her physical beauty, but because of who she was, who she is on the inside. And the second is Rebbetzin Shengel Fiorstein, who was a Rebbetzin in Livingston, New Jersey. Zichrona Levracha, she passed away. But she was a brilliant mind. She, to me, when I think of what brilliance is, when it comes to a woman knowing Torah knowledge, that was her. She went to Harvard. She spoke Torah. She was able to quote psukim left and right, no problem. She understood people. She understood life. She offered advice. She genuinely cared about people. Those are the things that, when I think of beauty, those are the people who, when I think of beauty, are the people who made an impression on me. And I'm sure that all of you have someone in your mind who, forget what the outside looks like, but their inside shines through. And elaborating on that a little bit more, so the Gemara talks about the four most beautiful women. Sarah, Rahab, Abigail, and then there's a machlokas of whether Vashti or Esther. And when it talks about this, it says that that Rachav, just by stating her name, the lust that was associated with her, she must have been a beautiful woman. We can talk about who she was at a later point in time and how she sort of like totally changed her life. But her physical beauty was so amazing that her name invoked like men to have crazy thoughts about her. And Abigail says that she had great memory, and that's what made her beautiful. And hold on one second. There's one more. Okay, I can't find it right now. A smile can make a person beautiful. Who we are, how we work on ourselves, our midos are what make a person beautiful. So I think that we often focus, because our society is so obsessed with what's on the magazine aisle when you're shopping at Jewel, or what's on the billboards that we see, right? But the things that really make a person beautiful are their inside, and the inside is a reflection of the outside. And I hope that these three ideas will kind of guide us when we are feeling lousy about ourselves to, number one, remind ourselves that I'm created in the image of Hashem. I'm a reflection of God. I'm a precious child of Hashem. Just like I would talk to my daughter in a certain way, I should talk to myself that way. The same talking points that I would give to my child, I have to validate for myself as well. Number two is Shchoran Anivinava. I have imperfections. I'm not perfect, right? Like you said about women when they're pregnant and they're, oh, I'm a house. I'm huge. I'm enormous. You're housing a child inside of you. What's more beautiful than that, right? And I do it all the time. I'm saying, like, we all fall prey. We all know the advice, but we have to kind of, you know, live it in our own way. You know, talk about stretch marks, and I kind of think of them as like war wounds. Like they're not anything I would ever be proud of per se, like to show off in public. But you know, having been extremely overweight and having lost a lot of weight, I think of them as, wow, like I'm able to tone parts of my body I never imagined would ever be able to be toned. And third is that beauty manifests itself according to the Torah in many different ways. It's not just physical beauty. Certainly, it's not just what your body looks like, or what your hair looks like, or what your face looks like. But it's so much more than that. It's really who you are as a person, how you treat other people, how you behave in the privacy of your own home. All of those things are really the things that make a person beautiful. And I would venture to say that if I were to poll the audience, that you would think of someone who's beautiful not because of their physical attributes, but rather from the things that they are in their personality and their midos. And that those things ultimately reflect on who they are on the outside. So that's what I have to offer for today.
Does anybody have questions that they wrote out? We have a couple more minutes. If you wrote it on the note card, I can collect it.
Go just ask.
I think we prefer that they're on the card. It's like the policy of the forum. Okay. So I have a couple. If people are anxious to go, we totally understand. And also, Kayla's handing out a sheet for you guys to review the programs. If you have thoughts, we really welcome your feedback. But okay, so this is for Dr. Gottman, but anybody could answer. But so what should a woman do when it's her husband who is the one making her feel insecure?
Like, I should give you one easy answer. Yeah. That's why I'm
a
therapist.
30 seconds.
Mind you, I can always put the push there. Nope, you may need to see a therapist. It may be helpful.
Is there like a mantra? Is there something she could do for herself? Not obviously, maybe they need therapy, it could be a big, but is there something you could do internally that could help a person who feels like the challenge is external?
Well, and that's kind of what I'm saying. It's hard to give you a yes, no, black, white answer, because I can look at this and I can say, is her husband, and that's why what got me into couples work to begin with, because each person's perception of reality is their reality. And sometimes you need the two realities in the room to really be able to see it. So, in fact, you may have someone who's emotionally abusive or, you know, disrespectful or demeaning. And I think what has to happen there is that a woman, it's not just tough it up, and that was the point I made. You can't just say stiff upper lip and I'm going to take it. You can do that for a certain period of time, because it may be that he's going through something tough at work, as I said, for example, or personally, or with his extended family. And so you want to, I think there was an article in today's Times about the necessity sometimes of little lies, and that we can't always be absolutely honest and say whatever you're saying to me is, you sometimes you just need to let it ride and blow over. But if it's a constant, number one, is there something that you're doing that's self-disparaging that he gloms onto and reacts to and sort of echoes, sort of along the line of what Mrs. Gutstein was saying, that we reflect one another. But I think my final answer really is communication. Somehow you have to find a time and a place, probably not just before you're going to bed, probably to be able to say, you know, I'd love to go out for a coffee, do it in a public place so that we're not going to come to blows, and just to go out and have a pleasant time and let me share some of what's going on. The most important thing that anyone will tell you when you're having fights with your husband, the pointing finger has to go. It can't be, you are doing this. What you have to be able to say is, this is how it's making me feel. It may not be what you intended, but this is how it's making me feel. As soon as you get accusatory, he may go on the offensive, he may withdraw, he may deny, and you're off and running. Talk about how you feel.
I have a whole list, because we only have the room so long. Okay, so this is for either Reiki or Tsipora. So, we talked about loving ourselves and raising children to love themselves, but what happens when young women get into shidduchim and all of a sudden it really is a lot of it external, at least for first impressions. So just want to hear, any thoughts on that about...
It's all
it is hard. I'm saying even within our culture, there is that emphasis on the external. And I know everyone has different ways of dealing with it. Some people refuse to give pictures. Some people will only give pictures if the boy give pictures. I mean, like, everyone has their own method of dealing with it. I think our goal is to, again, build this resilience in our children that, you know, you are a whole being. You are a whole picture. You have your internals and your externals, and everything is meshed together. And as Tsipora was saying, right, your internals is really what makes you you. And to try to, it's not easy, but to, you know, instill with our children this confidence that they're beautiful, that they have a lot to offer. When I see a lot of kids in my private practice, and a lot of the kids have self-esteem issues, right? And what I'm trying to build within them is that they have so much to offer. They'll tell me, but I don't have any talents. I can't sing. I can't dance. I can't this. But we talk about, but you're so funny and you're so kind and you're such a good friend. You're bringing a lot to the table here. So to, again, instill within our children that you're a whole picture. Your external is just your outer reflection. Who you are is really from the inside, and to give them that confidence when they're going into the shidduch system, to not be demeaned, you know, not let somebody demean them.
I'm just going to say that as far as the shidduch, because it's very tempting to sort of react and talk about women, and I'm going to put a push here because a lot of this has to do with the guys. And so, I mean, the shidduch crisis and all that goes on is a whole subject unto itself, but I think there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of educating our boys. So I'm going to end it right there. I could go on and on, but I'm going to end it right there.
If you want to ask a question, if you want to write it down, and I'll collect them. You have one? Great.
Well, not everybody
knows it's me, though.
Great, sorry.
Not everybody knows it's me, though. No, we're trying. Because we're so just looking at it.
Okay. What are we supposed to think when it is the from world that is giving us a negative image?
Like, in the sense... Can I explain? What I mean by that is, like, a lot of times, and, like, they're people that I love, but, like, I see mothers that are better looking than me, and it makes it very hard to compete with in dating or, like, the rest of the world. Just like how people are so image-obsessed that sometimes I feel like it's almost worse than what we see. I mean, magazines are one thing, but we see it every day in our daily lives. Like, people, you know, I feel kind of silly, like, just sprouting this out loud now, but, like, you know, the mothers who have the really long shade dolls and the high heels and just look like perfect walking Barbie dolls. And, like, when you're a single girl, how do you compete with that? Like, it's just...
I don't. I don't think necessarily that those people represent the Torah approach. I don't think any one individual necessarily represents the Torah approach. I think that again, like a lot of this, like people who are so focused on the external, a lot of it's coming from insecurity, right? A lot of it's coming from. I don't want to put out just because that image you created. I don't want to say that those people are insecure. It's not necessarily that those people are insecure. But I think when someone's image obsessed, right, it's coming from a very insecure place. It's coming from I need to put on this perfect picture to everybody else, because I don't really feel great about myself, okay? So I think that you have, I'm saying it's not looking to other people. It's about building security within yourself and feeling secure who you are as a person. You're not competing with anyone else. You're you. Do you know what I'm saying? And I need to feel secure with who I am and feel good about myself, feel good enough about myself, because if you're going to start comparing yourself to other people, it never stops, right? So now it might be about image. Then it's going to be about who has children first. Then it's going to be whose children are smarter. You got to just always, I think, try as much as you can to look to yourself and feel secure with who you are as yourself.
How do you do that, though? I appreciate what you're saying, yeah. To feel secure within yourself, but how, doing things you enjoy, helping people, how do you? I know I'm not supposed to ask that right now.
I mean,
how do you do that?
Do you want to answer? How do you
feel good within yourself?
I mean, I can talk from personal experience. I don't know if you know my story. I spoke last year, so just very briefly, I was about 275 pounds. That was 5 or 6 years ago, and I didn't realize how big I was. I didn't realize how unhappy I was. I wasn't secure in myself. I pretended like to the outside world. I mean, anyone who knew me then, and a lot of you did know me then, for sure thought that, like, you know, there was this pretty picture of Revitson, 3 kids, life is great, you know, entertaining all the time, just running myself ragged. And so, I mean, for me personally, I can talk about my experience about how I became self-aware. So I think it was a combination of a lot of different things, but one in particular was I had to get a hold of my health. I realized that I was significantly overweight, that I was on a fast track to just getting bigger. And so, I mean, it was a process, but it was, you know, I started going to the gym, and then I met someone who, like this Rebbe, who I mentioned, came up to this very ugly person and said, "You're so ugly." This woman came up to me and she said, "You look really unhappy." And I was like, "You know what? I really am unhappy." And she started to help me to take care of myself. And once I started to nurture myself and put myself first, I started to be able to take care of everything else, and life sort of started to fall into place. And I think very often when we're so conscious of everyone else, and this person has, you know, that house and I want that house, or this person has that wig and I want that wig, or that husband, and we start to look at, for me, it was a lot about self-reflection and trying to look inside, seeing who am I? Who do I want to be as a person? What kind of a wife do I want to be? What kind of a mother do I want to be? And I think a lot of it is time, taking the time to just, to reflect. Like I said, when you look in that mirror in the morning, you're like, oh, you know, like we all do it. We all, walking by, you know, if you're at a wedding and you walk by a mirror and we all kind of like peek in the mirror to see what every part of our body looks like, right? Taking the time to sit down and think about who am I? What are my strengths? What do I have to offer in this world? You know, on my way here this morning, and when I was sort of like collecting my thoughts, and I guess you would say I'm a spiritual person, so I was talking to God. So I said, like, I just hope that you can help me articulate your purpose for me in this world. So a lot of it is finding out what is our purpose, what makes me great, what are my strengths, and knowing my weaknesses also. And so for me, it became this sort of personal journey of, you know, fitness, but it also manifested itself very much in a spiritual way also. Like I said, that talking to God, thinking about I'm a child of Hashem, I have to love myself. We have to love ourselves. If we don't love ourselves, so all we give off is self-hatred to our kids, to everyone. I mean, there are people in the room who knew me 5 years ago who I was obnoxious to because I didn't feel great about myself, so I was obnoxious to them. I didn't say hello to them, or I didn't whatever. And so, you know, there's a lot of work that we're a work in progress. We constantly have to work on ourselves. And I think that it's taking the time to see who am I, what am I, when it comes to dating, you know, what kind of person do I want to be, what kind of spouse do I want to look for, what kind of mother do I want to be, and that self-reflection very often sort of starts to guide you. I think it's also surrounding yourself with people who are positive, and like you said, Rachie, about being proactive, it has to start here. It has to start, you know, from within our community. It's true, I'm sure, that, you know, it's intimidating to see people who are, you know, married with, like you said, long wigs and high heels. I happen to have a long wig right now, and I'm wearing high heels, right? And so I'm like, oh my gosh. Right? And of course, my mind goes to, but I'm not, like, you know, that thin person, so, like, I don't fit her criteria, so I'm okay. But I do think, you know, I think that it has to start as a community, focusing on the important things, right? When we compliment, I once heard a therapist talk about this, where when we compliment our children, not to say, oh, you're so pretty, right? Or I had a client this week tell me, oh, you look so skinny. And right away I was like on the bandwagon to like jump down her throat and say, skinny's not a compliment, right? I would never tell my daughter she looks so skinny, right? I would tell her she looks healthy, she looks strong. Happens to be this person is a social worker, and I afterward apologize for being so strong about not accepting the compliment. We have to accept compliments, by the way, also. Someone tells you you look good, say thank you. In fact, I like to say thank God, because really, like I said initially, it's Hashem who made me. It's Hashem who put me on this path of having been extremely overweight and now having, thank God, found health and found a way to keep myself healthy and to help other people be healthy and take care of themselves. I feel like I'm going but yeah, I think it's time and investing in yourself, if I had to answer.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you so much for coming.
That was amazing. Thank you.
Love the show.
Yes. I was right.
When did you find it?
Right.
Oh, you all have an RGP and an AD center. You're just invited. Please come.
Thank you.